Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 2:06 on a Wednesday afternoon. We're coming to you live, as we always do, from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting. We have so much. I keep saying this every week, but it's always true. We have so much to talk about on the show this week. The results of Michigan and Mississippi, the other two primaries last night. We have breaking news. As many of you have probably already heard, this morning, Carly Fiorina, the good soldier that she's become, announced that she was endorsing Ted Cruz for president, and we'll get to that in a little while. We're at Politics GPB. If you want to join the conversation by Twitter, we'd love to have your thoughts if you hear things that any of us say that you believe you want to respond to. I do want to start with the Democratic race, and I want to bring in our terrific panel today. Kyle Wingfield, columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is at the table today. You read his column in the Dead Tree edition of the AJC every Thursday and Sunday on the opinion page. Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs, and a major player in Republican Party politics, not just in Georgia, but in national politics over the years. He's a former chair of the Georgia Republican Party, was very close and worked for Jack Kemp when he was at Housing and Urban Development. Rusty, thank you so much
good
for
be
being
Thanks
back
for
with us today. Senator Nan Orrick. Democratic Senator Nan Orrick, who is one of the leading Democrats in the Georgia State Legislature and has a lot to say about presidential politics. But later in the show, we've got some interesting things to talk about in terms of state issues as well. So thank you for being here,
thank
Senator.
You.
And Angelo Fuster, who over the years has been a consultant to any number of Democrats in local politics, worked for Hillary Clinton's campaign back in 2008. Is that right, Angela?
That is correct.
All right. Terrific. Well, then, let's start by talking about the Democratic race last night. Clearly, Kyle, Hillary Clinton did what she needed to do in Mississippi. She scored well there. I mean, there were four primaries, but Hawaii and Idaho were sort of smaller players in this. But what the heck happened to her in Michigan? The polls all said she was going to win it, and Bernie Sanders picked off the state.
The polls were dead wrong. You know, they've been all over the place, really, in this primary. Sometimes they're right on it, and sometimes they're off by double digits. And this was one of those times they were off by double digits. And, you know, it definitely speaks to, we've talked so much about the divide on the Republican side and the angst about the front runner there. And I think it shows that still exists on the Democratic side, too.
What does that mean? How does it exist on the Democratic side? What's the divide there?
You know, again, comparing it to the Republican side, we hear so much about, well, it's time to get behind the front runner and coalesce and party unity and get ready for the general election. And that's with four people still in the race there. You've got two people on the Democratic side. I don't think anyone thinks Bernie Sanders could possibly be the nominee at this point. It's almost mathematically impossible when you look at the delegates. And yet here you have a state like Michigan going out and handing him a surprise victory at this stage of the race. I think it shows that the unsettled feeling exists on both sides.
Yeah, Nan, this wasn't good news for Hillary Clinton. As Kyle points out, she's got quite a lead in delegates. But we do have some more of those Midwestern states that potentially could have a mix in terms of Democrats going to the polls, a bit like Michigan, union workers, working class Democrats, who they're not excited about her policies on trade in the past. He's hit her, Sanders has, over and over again.
It's a big issue there.
Big issue. So the question is this just an exciting moment for all of us who follow this? Or could Bernie Sanders really be picking up some momentum that could make him an authentic challenger moving forward?
Well, as Kyle said, I don't see how the numbers work for Hillary to lose, for her to not come out with the delegates that she needs. The race is still very exciting, and it was we watched with bated breath last night as they rallied up those votes. And I'm in a split household since I have someone far junior to me in my household.
Wait, so you've got a Sanders person in the house.
That's right.
You're ready. You canceled each other out on March 1st, I assume.
No
let's do this before we continue this conversation. It's so much fun to watch the victory speeches, and in a little while we're going to listen to what Donald Trump said last night. But Bernie Sanders was as pumped up last night as I think I've ever seen him. He was feeling the burn in a very big way last night. He had a hugely enthusiastic young crowd in Florida with him. Let's just listen to a little bit of what he had to say.
What the wealthy and powerful want, this is really what they want. No one says this. This is the truth. They want young people not to participate in the political process. They want your friends to say, oh, politics, it's all crap. I'm not going to get involved. They want working class people to say, you know what? Nobody in Washington cares about me. I'm not going to vote. When you have low voter turnouts, then you have billionaires buying elections. And that is what we have got to overturn, what we have got to show. What we have got to show the American people is that when we don't allow the Trumps of the world to divide us up, when we stand together, black and white and Latino, gay and straight, they may have all of the money and all of the power, but you know what we got? You're seeing it here tonight. We have the people.
Rusty Paul, excuse me. Hillary Clinton may be the inevitable nominee, but she could have virtually closed it out completely had she won Michigan last night. Instead, she gives Sanders this opening.
Well, look at what's going on. If you got to look at the trends and what's going on both parties, and there's a commonality going on here. You've got Bernie Sanders on the left that's tapped into the populism of the left, and you've got Trump that has really become the populist of the right. I'm afraid they may merge on the backside at some point, but
stranger things have happened.
And so, and what they have picked up on is the zeitgeist of this particular time, which is the tremendous amount of angst that people feel about the political class, that the political class has let them down, and it's a pox on both their houses.
9 out of 10 GOP voters, Angelo, in Michigan and Mississippi told exit pollsters yesterday, that they were angry with what's happening in this country. That's a powerful message, and that's what Rusty Paul is speaking to.
Well, you know, Trump certainly is angry at everything and conveys that anger, and Bernie does the same thing. I mean, he gesticulates and all that. Listening to that recording now, I was remembering I was in graduate school listening to George McGovern and having a crowd of people doing the same kind of enthusiasm. He was not, in my view then, he was not the cantankerous old uncle that Bernie comes across as he comes across. But there was the same enthusiasm, and he said all the right things, and he lost every state but one.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So that's the worry that people like me have. I agree with a lot of things that Bernie has out there, but they are unrealistic. He's not learned the art of compromising is how many, 20, 30 years in public office. And so he votes against the bailout for the automakers. Why? Because he was bundled with a Wall Street issue. When he was separate, he was for it. When he became, and that was the only way to get it through.
Yes, but you just raised an interesting issue. Hillary Clinton pounded him on that over and over again in the run-up to yesterday's Michigan election. You would think that voting against the bailout might, Kyle Wingfield, have had voters, Democratic voters, thinking that he was not the best candidate for them, and yet he won.
Well, this political season, more than any I've ever witnessed, the ways that voters are leaning, they have less of a connection to the candidate's past statements, past positions, track record,
reason,
anything. I mean, this is a very emotional response on both sides that people have had. It gets to what Rusty was saying about, you know, the populism of the moment. But I haven't quite put my finger on it, but I think it goes beyond that. I think it is a purely emotional reaction that people are having all across the political spectrum. And it makes it impossible for those of us who try to pin it down and figure out and draw, you know, connect the dots when the dots don't there's no way to connect them in the way that they're that people are showing up and voting.
Well, you know, I really do hold to the view that the blocking, constant and consistent and vociferous blocking of everything in Washington by, in my opinion, the GOP, who announced when Obama was elected that their job was to be sure he was a one-term president. That was our number one goal. And the public really doesn't want to see gridlocked government. Transportation is a fabulous example. That transportation bill has been tied up in Washington for years. The money hasn't been flowing to the states. The states have been starving for transportation dollars. And here in Georgia, we go year after year after year until last year's breakthrough on getting any substantial progress on funding our infrastructure needs for transportation. And people want solutions. They don't want rhetoric. They don't want and I think it does create what Washington's broken. Nothing's happening. You can't get anything done. I get it all the time in my email from in-town residents who want transit, for example, fixed. They want that done, and I think it contributes to a malaise across the land, no matter what your party, that things aren't working.
Well, there, you know, first of all, I doubt very seriously that the Democrats wished any of the Republican presidents that I've worked for very well and wanted to make sure that their term ended just as fast as it could possibly be. That's what the opposition party's role is, at least one of them. And but there is a deeper emotion here. As you know, I've spent my entire adult life trying to analyze political trends and so on. And this one caught me somewhat by surprise, at least the depth of the anger. I mean, you get it. You look at the elections, even local elections in this area last year, you had a lot of incumbents that lost local elections. And this is something that starts at the grassroots and goes all the way through to the top. Just a real frustration that basic things aren't getting done. And it's something both parties need to sit down and figure out.
Angelo, I was struck. It isn't as if he said it for the first time last night, but for some reason it really popped out at me last night, partly because the rally that Bernie Sanders held was so very enthusiastic, and he was in such a high-spirited mood. We played the sound in the opening of the show. He said, "I think what you're telling me is you want a political revolution." And all of a sudden last night, I thought, gee, that's that kind of rhetoric. I'm not sure how well that plays with the majority of American voters. You know, where this is the Bolsheviks.
That is a real practical concern, and that rhetoric, and the reaction to it is not acceptable to a large percentage of the American voters. And a related concern is that Bernie keeps pushing Hillary in that direction, which runs counter to what she has to do for the general
which is
election.
A real problem, isn't it, Kyle? I mean, the longer he's in this race, the more she is going to have to move herself left in a way that general election voters might not be happy about.
Especially when she's someone with such a long history and who, you know, voters don't necessarily trust to start with. You know, I've been thinking about how the difference really between the Democrats and the Republicans when it comes to this issue is that it's just Bernie and Hillary on the Democratic side. Imagine if Joe Biden had gotten in. Imagine if Martin O'Malley had had any traction whatsoever. And you could have had Bernie Sanders at a third of the vote every time, just like Trump is doing on the Republican side, and the other half, or the other two-thirds, rather, being fragmented the way it is on the Republican side. And we'd be taking these words about political revolution a little bit differently, I think,
interesting,
if we really thought that there was a chance he was going to get there.
All right. I want to, excuse me again, I want to play just a little bit of Hillary Clinton's speech last night. And I want to ask you if you will all, we can talk about the content of her message, but I also think it's worth taking a moment to talk about the superficial impressions that come across. I want to talk about the optics of Hillary Clinton as a speaker these days, because I don't think that is necessarily just superficial. I think it says something about how you connect to voters. Let's listen to just a couple minutes of Hillary.
I've seen the young people in Flint, Michigan working to help and heal their community. I've met entrepreneurs across this country in city after city who are starting small businesses. And I've met mothers who've lost their children to gun violence. They're turning their mourning into a movement. All of them are living out what the scripture tells us. Let us not grow weary in doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. If we reach for love and kindness instead of bluster and bigotry, we can see the best in each other, not the worst. If we lift each other up instead of tearing each other down, there's nothing we can't do together. So I am grateful to all of you. If you work for me and if you vote for me, I will work my heart out for you. I will work every single day to make a difference in your lives, to knock down the barriers that stand in your way, to make sure that every child has a chance to live up to his or her God-given potential, and that
So, Nanork, I let that play out a little bit because it strikes me it showed us two sides of the way Hillary Clinton speaks when she talks to an audience. The first part of that particular sound, she's very... she's communicating to us as a real person. She's quoting scripture. She's talking about sensitive, talking about stuff with emotion. And then she turns to that more strident tone that we're really used to hearing from her in a lot of her speeches. And I get that a candidate's tone is a somewhat superficial thing to discuss. But as I said, I think we all agree that it does matter as you try to tell voters who you are. So does she have a tone problem at times?
Well, let me say this. Women are judged differently than men on the on the campaign trail. And I see that every day with Hillary. And I never hear men called strident. I never hear men called strident when they're opining. But I've been called strident, and I was called strident when I first stepped out to run for office. She's too strident. She'll never make it. But I don't hear that term applied to men. Show me, you know, tell me something I'm not seeing. I thought that was a moving passage, and it had an authenticity to it. And I very much like that she's holding up a vision of America being made whole and coming together. I think there's potency there.
So I think, Angelo, I get that there's a different standard. I think there probably is. I think you make a point there. But as much as it has to do with her gender, the first part of that, she really connects with people as a human being, and then she doesn't so much. Then she feels this need to rally the troops. And whether maybe strident's the wrong word, but it's there that she suddenly distances herself from the very people she's trying to reach, I think.
And I think that she doesn't do it in a particularly good way, in an effective way. She goes from the personal to the public in a way that doesn't quite work. It did not work last night. But the issue of the women's issue is important. I have two daughters. One is 24 and one is 27. They're both Hillary supporters, strong Hillary supporters. They get it. They get it. And they watch. They were watching the debate, Bernie and Hillary. And when Bernie started poking his finger at her and saying, "Wait, you turn," you know, and they thought, you know, guys do that to girls. And that's not good.
So am I, Rusty Paul, am I making too much of nothing here? Or am I being superficial?
No, in today's media world, you have to, how you come across really does matter. And you've got to come across differently in different media. I mean, Marshall McLuhan told us that 50 years ago. You know, you get TV's hot, radio's cold. Or vice versa, I forget.
That's all right. I can never get it straight, and I work in both. Yeah.
The difference with Hillary, though, is she's effective when she talks to an audience and not so much when she speaks to an audience. And there's a difference. The first part, she was talking. She was just sharing who she was and what she had experienced. Then the crowd reacted, and then she started speaking to them. And that's the difference. When she goes from talker, connective, to speaker, is when that disappears.
Yeah, and along those lines, it comes across as poorly done, as Angelo says, because I think she's doing it because she feels like she's supposed to, that she's reacting to all that we've been talking about the passion of the moment and the anger and the angst that are out there in the electorate. And I think she's forcing it. It doesn't come across as being who she really is. And you know, so I, in this particular case, I don't see it as an issue of her gender. I think it's an issue of authenticity and whether she's playing to the crowd in a way that she's really not good at.
I've said it
versus
being
herself.
I've said it before on the show that I spent a lot of time covering the Clintons when the campaign was on back in the 90s and then at the White House. And Hillary Clinton is about as charming and lovely a person in real life as you can want to meet. And it just doesn't help her that she isn't able to translate that. Nan Oreck and Angelo are two Democrats. I am going to turn to you and then we're going to take a break. We got a tweet from Vash Talk. She asks, can Hillary win in the general election without a credible progressive like Elizabeth Warren on her ticket? How does she get young liberal voters?
Well, I like the idea of the senator from Ohio.
Okay.
His name was mentioned last night, Sherrod Brown.
Okay.
Brown, who has got a wonderful way about him. He's very, very, very progressive. And has shown a lot of independence, is a strong Hillary supporter, and comes from a very important state. I think that is an important voice that could be at her side.
Yeah,
Elizabeth Warren would be piling on, and I don't think that would work. I like Julian Castro as a vice presidential.
I would agree. His name is very, very attractive candidate.
Well, I think the larger question is, and then we're going to take a break. I do think the larger question that is being asked is Hillary going to have trouble with young voters in the general election? If it's Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I think young voters decide that they've got something better to do on election day, don't you imagine?
I don't know in that scenario that's how she gets at that. I mean, I guess I would think, and we were talking earlier about how she's going to have trouble pivoting toward the center. And Trump, I think, unlike any candidate before him, will be able to turn completely on his heel from what he's been saying in the primary.
He does
something
it day
totally
to day.
Different. I mean, he does it breath to breath within the same breath.
Well, he has no issue position, so that should be easy
right.
to do.
Yeah. I mean, he can go back to what he used to say on some of these issues.
All right. Look, we have to take a break. When we come back, we really do need to take a deeper dive into what happened in the Republican primaries yesterday. And we need to listen to a little of Donald Trump's infomercial from last night. For my money, one of the bizarrest political events I've ever personally watched. It's almost 2:29 on Wednesday afternoon. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in just a moment.
Whether you know David Sedaris from his best-selling books, his appearances on This American Life, or his hilarious Santa Land Diaries, you won't want to miss GPB's Evening with David Sedaris in Savannah on April 16th. There is still time for you to receive premium seats for this unforgettable event with your support of GPB. Go to gpb.org/David. That's gpb.org/David. And thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. At the table today, Democrat Angelo Fuster and Senator Nan Oreck, Republican Mayor of Sandy Springs, Rusty Paul, former chair of the Georgia Party, Republican Party, and the AJC columnist Kyle Wingfield. Okay, so
a member of the left-wing conspiracy, right? The liberal
exactly. No, conspiracy. Kyle, you know, the AJC, we've kidded him about this
no,
on the
I
show
know,
before, that the AJC, which we love to read day out, is so concerned about making sure that its readers know that they're balanced, that they tag you there, Angelo. You know
I
that.
Know it.
He carries
know
the tag
it.
Conservative columnist.
I know. Hasn't that gotten kind of ridiculous?
Yeah,
well,
it does.
We won't continue that conversation because we love the AJC and people
we
like
do.
Kyle and
we
Jim Galloway, who, by the way, is on jury duty today. That's why he's not here doing his civic duty. They're great contributors to this show.
We have something for everyone.
That's exactly
AJC.
Right.
I think that's the point.
So I want to get all of you to weigh in, obviously. But I sat and I watched, I guess about almost a half hour of Donald Trump before I just gave up. I mean, I think he went on for like 40 plus minutes. Mm. He was at his golf resort in Jupiter, Florida.
Jupiter.
And he was playing to apparently, it was in a fairly elegant room. Of course he was. And as he had done last week, instead of holding a rally, he had a smaller crowd and it was more like a smoker's club speech is the only way I could describe it. And members of the golf resort were there. And it was the single most bizarre victory speech I have ever seen in my life. Because what he did was try to respond to Mitt Romney, if you didn't see it, who said he has all these failed businesses. And he had literally a table with Trump steaks, Trump magazine.
Trump water.
Trump water, Trump wine. Let's just, and he talked about these things. Let's just listen to a little of this.
So you have the water, you have the steaks, you have the airline that I sold. I mean, what's wrong with selling? Every once in a while you can sell something. You have the wines and all of that. And Trump University, we're going to start it up as soon as I win the lawsuit. Does that make sense? I mean, that's it. Okay. I think what this shows, really more than anything else, is that advertising is not as important. It really isn't as important as competence. Because there has never been more money spent on hitting somebody than was spent on me. And, you know, if you think about it, every single person that's attacked me has gone down. Okay? We started off with 17. We're down to 4. Of the 4, they're pretty much all gone. Okay? Pretty much. They didn't do so well tonight, folks. Okay? I'm not going to say anybody didn't do well. They didn't do well. There's only one person did well tonight, Donald Trump. I will tell you. Sure.
So, Rusty, at a certain point, as I was watching, I sort of, instead of seeing Donald Trump, I sort of saw Dean Martin holding a martini glass and a cigarette and kind of just swaggering out on the stage and just saying whatever came to his head.
Well, that's kind of the stream of consciousness that is that typifies Donald Trump. You know, it reminded me of the time when Bob Dole in New Hampshire had his entire voting record stacked up in about, you know, a 10-foot stack of paper and shoved it toward George Bush and said, quit lying about my record. Mitt Romney went after him at his core, which is as a successful businessman. If you could challenge Donald Trump's success as a business person, then you're getting at part of his mystique. And I think that Trump, kind of in Dole fashion, rolled out all the stuff to prove that I am a successful businessman. And, you know,
of course, virtually nothing he said about any of those products is actually factual. No.
Which is par for the course.
Right.
In this game.
You know, and something we talked about, this came up in the first part of our conversation, Kyle. You talk about the fact that past records don't much matter this year. Trump has been hit, as he said, with millions and millions of dollars of negative ads that have attempted to go back, pull out things he has said that his opponents would find offensive to Republican voters. Mm-hmm. They don't mean anything.
Well, you we're talking earlier about emotion. You don't reason someone out of a position they didn't use reason to get into. And I think this is not something where people sat down with the platforms and the plans and the track record and said, okay, out of all the boxes here, Donald Trump ticks the most. I mean, you know, it's really ironic. He probably ticks the fewest traditional Republican and conservative boxes of any candidate. We've been through a period where if a Republican only ticked 9 out of 10 boxes, he was a rhino. You know, and a closet liberal and couldn't be trusted. And here you've got Trump, who maybe ticks 3, 4 out of 10. I don't know. But, you know, it doesn't matter.
What's really interesting about that, Rusty, and I hadn't thought about it until Kyle said that, is you potentially have, and we'll ask about whether you think this is going to happen, is Trump going to be the nominee? But first, if he is, there is no litmus test for him in terms of his Republican credentials. But virtually every down ballot race that will be on the general election ballot, there will be litmus tests for members of Republicans in Congress, even for some statewide elections here in Georgia. You'd better be a true conservative Republican in the down ballot races, even if the guy who heads the ticket isn't held to any of those standards.
Well, Donald Trump has tapped into, I am a member of the most rapidly disappearing demographic in politics. It's called the angry white man.
And you're not as angry as you
used to. You're a lot less angry than the old days, Rusty.
I've mellowed in my older years, but that's kind of the force that's fueling him right now, and that's what's got the Republican establishment scared to death, is because those down ballot races. If you look toward the, and I know that we've got several months before we get there, and this is why, if you want to know why the Republican establishment is petrified, they're looking at the numbers for the fall election and seeing Donald Trump's negatives twice as high as his positives among general election voters. Losing the White House for the 12th straight year is bad enough, but having majorities in the Senate, in the U.S. House, and state legislators being potentially wiped out or significantly reduced is what has everybody scared to death. If you care about a conservative agenda, you need to be as concerned about holding on to all of those seats as you do holding on to the presidency. And that's why the Republican establishment is just petrified by Donald Trump.
And you face the possibility of losing good policy-driven Republicans in the Georgia General Assembly, like Brandon Beach.
Yeah. All right, should we all be? Let's forget for a moment about this as a partisan presidential contest, but rather let's talk about it as a sociological phenomenon, if that's fair. You can handle those words, Angelo. You
know, yes, I can.
do we all, whether we're Democrats or Republicans, have reasons to be concerned about what we're seeing unfold? Watching a Trump last night, watching Trump in his the authoritarian label that's being applied to him now, voters who don't care about whether he gives them any specifics, voters who aren't concerned whether he used to be a Democrat, that he gave money to Hillary Clinton. Do we have reasons to be concerned that this has turned into the people are so angry that they're blinded to everything but the fact that this guy is a big celebrity who says, I'll fix all the problems? I mean, what's happening?
The real concern, I think, is what this is doing and what this is revealing about the body politic.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
And that there is this, nothing matters, but we will take the guy who says, I'll fix everything tomorrow, and I'm going to make you great again, and I'm going to force the Mexicans to build this wall. And a long list of things that you cannot say, words that you cannot say on the radio, and still people just go for the initial reaction to it, and they like it because he says it forcefully, and he no matter what you ask him, he will throw back his slogans and his little lines, you know, and people buy it and people ignore it. And
the mood at some of these rallies, I mean, it had already been
ugly.
Somewhat ugly, but it's gotten even uglier. There was a video this last week of a protester. And of course, Trump has always been tough on protesters, but she was so badly mishandled by the crowd. A young African-American woman was pushed around, shoved. Apparently, racial epithets were yelled at her. And then we had the incident where Trump asked people, I thought playfully, I thought innocently, to raise their hands and pledge to go and vote for him. And many of my colleagues in the media decided to compare
like
that
rally
to a Nazi salute. Nevertheless, this authoritarian vibe is in the air.
Well, because he was in that context. If he had just done that and there had not been a context of being so rough with people who object to his presence or to what he's saying, we would not have the same reaction to him, people raising the right hand and swearing.
But what do you make of all that?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think of all the substantive things that worry me, you know, having people raise their hand for a pledge is probably the least worrying. But it is that, you know, I'm going to change the libel laws to bring the media to heel. And, you know, this series of things, changes that he's going to make to push us in a less democratic, small d democratic direction as a country. And just this strong man aura that he gives off. I think it's broadly worrying in that if we get to a place where people are going to choose candidates based on their personality and, let's face it, their lack of specifics that give the voters nothing to be opposed to. I mean, we've seen this play out in the Republican Party for several years now. You pop your head up with any kind of idea, and it gets shot down as, no, we can't do that. Well, no, we can't do this other. Well, no, we can't do this other. Well, Trump is, I mean, brilliantly, frighteningly, however you want to put it, completely avoided giving anyone anything other than the wall that they could possibly object to. He's been so nonspecific. It's just, you know, I'm great and things will be great when I'm president.
Yeah, the bullying persona is very alarming. I mean, we've been on a campaign now for years in this country to discourage bullying in schools and that kind of bullying among children and things that can really, you know, lead to teen suicide. And here we have it writ large with this man. And then to see, Bill, as you pointed out, shoving and pushing of young African-American women by Big Burley.
Photographers.
Very troubling. And the you know, there have been so many things since then, but remember the disabled journalist who had a visible disability mocking him. It just goes on and on and on, and it's not a road that any of us in this room want to see our nation take.
Rusty, I want to give you a chance to weigh in this, and then I want to make a turn that I also like you to just keep going on. So we go to Florida. Ted Cruz, all the gains that Cruz got last weekend in terms of delegates were wiped out by Trump last night. So we moved toward Florida. You still got Marco Rubio, who was third and fourth, got nothing again, has not so far decided to get out of the race. So go ahead and address this authoritarian stuff.
Let me go back to your original question, which was, is there something within the body politic that we should be concerned about? Think about this election. You've got a billionaire with no track record who has been as inspecific about issues as you can imagine. And on the other side, who would have ever imagined that in the United States of America, an avowed socialist, socialist would get the kind of following he has? Is there a concern about the body politic? You're doggone right there is. There's something wrong when you've got that kind of dichotomy and there's no political center to pull people together toward.
All right. So that said, you now go to Florida and Ohio on March 15th, week from yesterday. And, you know, the question is, if Trump wins both states, it's all over, isn't it?
It's over now. I mean, I'll tell you, it's over now.
You don't see?
I don't see a way that you stop Donald Trump at this point. I mean, you look at the states that are coming up, California, New York, Pennsylvania. He's going to do extremely well in those. From my perspective, the Republican presidential race is over.
Is Marco Rubio, Kyle, I want to be careful about this, but this is a guy who's been finishing third and fourth for weeks now, state after state. He won Puerto Rico. Give him credit for that. But why is he staying in this race? He's at a point where all he can be is a blocker, right? And he doesn't even seem ready to do that effectively.
Well, I think that he has a role to play as a spoiler. Unlike Rusty, I don't think it's a cinch that that Trump gets the nomination at this point. I think if he somehow loses Ohio and Florida on Tuesday, the math gets really difficult for him. He's got to win 60-something percent of the delegates the rest of the way.
Okay, but we should say he's way up in Florida. Not so. In Ohio's still a little bit more up in the air.
The polls are... There's some discrepancy there, polls.
And
when I talk to the Rubio people, they feel like, based on their own internal numbers, the polls are very wrong. And we saw just last night in Michigan that the polls can be off by a long way. So they're counting on that. But I do think if they can get to a convention with no clear winner, I think there are a lot of people in the Republican Party ready to do what it takes, even if it means losing this election, to make sure that Trump does not become the face of the party.
Yeah, I mean, that does strike me as the one position that Rubio might occupy at this point, that who knows, a brokered convention maybe will elevate me to the nomination. On the other hand, Angelo, Nan, either of you are welcome to weigh in. You know, one of the knocks on Rubio is that he seems kind of young and callow and just ambitious beyond his experience at this point. And there's a sense in which watching him cling to life and continue to hang on here and continue to find ways to make speeches that, you know, build up his poor showings kind of contributes to that image of him as just...
Oh, I think so. I mean, he's done. I think we all are in agreement.
Well,
with
I think Kyle's saying no, not necessarily.
No, I think he can still be a spoiler.
Right.
He cannot win the nomination.
The news just came out. Jeb Bush is meeting with Kasich... and Rubio and Ted Cruz.
Well, I got to imagine, I've never gotten to use this word before, that Jeb Bush has got to be watching what's happened to Marco Rubio with a certain degree of schadenfreude. You know, I mean, just he can't be watching that except with a delicious sense that this is what's happening to his former protege who turned on him.
One of the Trump supporters who was doing some commenting on one of the shows said there is an irony that the Cuban American is losing to the Cuban Canadian.
Real quick, Rusty, before we take a break, Kyle, you're welcome. Where are we stand on what about Cruz? Does Cruz still have an opportunity here?
Again, I think the spoiler role. I think that the only thing that could happen at this point, and I think the reason Rubio's staying in is he's hearing a lot from establishment Republicans. Stay in. Let's see what happens when you get to the convention. If we can broker the convention, then you may have a shot. You know, the last one was 1976. The system is so rigged right now that it's almost impossible to get there. It's I can do the math and show you that we can get there, but the question is how do you really pull it together in today's time?
I think this year is the exception to that rule of no brokered convention.
All right. I've got to get our second break in right now. When we come back, there's some really important state politics to talk about. And so we'll take our final break. It's 2:47. We'll be back on the other side.
On the next Fresh Air, inside the East Bay Rats, an Oakland motorcycle club with a reputation for boozing and brawling, we hear from writer Alex Abramovich, who wrote about the Rats after discovering that one of the members was the guy who'd bullied him years ago when they were kids. Abramovich has a new book called Bullies, A Friendship. Join us.
You can hear those interviews on Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 o'clock right here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Kyle Wingfield from the AJC, Mayor Rusty Paul of Sandy Springs, Democratic leader in the Senate, Nan Orok, and Democrat Angelo Fuster at the table. Rusty, let me come to you because MARTA is a big issue for you up in Sandy Springs, where you have great public transit, and I know you're happy about that. We thought the MARTA tax bill was dead a couple of weeks ago, and Mayor Kasim Reed gave an interview to the AJC, to our colleague Jim Galloway, and said, no, not so fast. We're going to figure out a way to make this work. It was kind of a surprising interview, considering that it seemed pretty clear that the Senate particularly had no interest in going there on this MARTA tax.
Well, I have tremendous respect for Mayor Reed. We've worked very closely together on this whole MARTA thing, along with Jerry Wood, the mayor of Roswell, trying to find a middle ground that we could bring everybody together toward. And I would extend MARTA to the Tennessee line if I could. because I think it's our future. It's what we're going from 6 million to 10 million. You can't move everybody in one person per vehicle increments. But as much as I respect the mayor of Atlanta and his commitment to transit and getting funding for it, I think it takes us – I don't think it gets us further down the road. I think we either got to go together or keep working toward finding a solution. If you look at what MART is planning, there's very little of the transit work that needs to be done within the city limits of Atlanta. It needs to be extended out into DeKalb County, out toward Emory University, north into Fulton County. But let me tell you, the interesting thing that happened, I think, in the Senate this week was that part of the group that killed this bill had no interest in, I mean, no connection to Fulton County. It was a couple of Gwinnett County senators, Renee Unterman and P.K. Martin. And I think there's becoming this understanding that MARTA is crucial to bringing in these large new business relocations. And Gwinnett has lost a lot of them because transit doesn't exist. And I think what you saw there is the folks in Gwinnett trying to buy a little time to get their folks on board and block North Fulton from being able to bring in more of the Mercedes-type projects.
Interesting.
And that was the interesting thing that caught my attention was how vociferous the Gwinnett delegation was about trying to block something that had no economic impact on them from a taxing point of view, but could have an enormous impact on their future economic growth.
Well, Senator, you were there. I mean, your chamber shut this thing down. Your colleague, Senator Brandon Beach, was, I think, caught off guard and devastated when the MARTA bill went down. He'd pushed very, very hard for it. Does Rusty Paul make good points here?
Well, yeah, and Senator Beach is absolutely coming from an economic development perspective. He is a chamber guy in North Fulton, and engages with policy very, very seriously. We worked on a number of things together, and it was a 1-2 punch that was unveiled all of a sudden. I believe it was on a Monday morning, mm-hmm. and with Gwinnett folks leading the way, really leading the way. And I don't know how to pull it all apart because the whole MARTA debate has been so shot through with race for decades. That's why the other counties are not in with Fulton and DeKalb and now Clayton County, because it was white flight counties that said, oh no, they'll come out here to our county if we build a rail, if we put in a service. The first Republican governor elected in modern time took apart our regional transportation authority as it stood, and there's just a very schizophrenic point of view inside the.
It's changing,
GOP.
Man.
It's changing, and I applaud your. You have been a clarion call about the impact.
I think there was a tremendous amount of shock when I stepped out on that issue because,
yes.
It's counterintuitive, I guess, in a lot of ways. But if you really care about the long term future of being able to move people in the region, we're going to have to do something. Roads are important, but we're going to have to do something to get transit and even maybe commuter rail in here. We've got to bite the bullet and go ahead and do it, accept it. The attitudes are changing. I think it's changing in Gwinnett County. I think it'll change in Cobb. It's definitely changed in our area. And Brandon and I have worked very closely on this, as we've worked with the mayor of Atlanta.
Kyle, is this going anywhere? Is this really dead?
I'd be surprised if anything actually passed this session. I know there's an effort in the House to try to do it through the local legislation piecemeal. But boy, you're tomorrow's day 34. At this point, the odds are stacked against you. I think there probably will be, as Rusty was talking about, some merit to the idea of saying, okay, this didn't go the way we thought it was going to go. Let's take a step back. Let's get on the same page and do it the right way next year. And there's been a lot of next year when it comes to MARTA and transit.
There was. Last year they were saying next year.
Yeah. We've made a lot of progress this year.
Well,
more progress than ever made, and so I'm optimistic we'll get there.
Death, tax reform, and MARTA discussions are your locks in life that you're always going to
have.
And other cities, meanwhile, measurably, you can the numbers don't lie. You can look at the track record of the cities that have gone with transit, and they're soaring. And so to have this block, this barrier to our own economic development continually thrust up. Last year, we voted for a transportation bill to raise revenue to do infrastructure, and transit was explicitly left out of the language of that bill with the promise that we would do the MARTA this year.
And it was left out because the votes weren't there to pass that bill with transit in it.
The first time the budget last year actually had state money for transit in the budget.
Well, right, but it came out.
Well, but even so, the Republicans put it in, and so that's a signal that things are changing. Mindsets
are
changing.
Some bond put it money in and took it out.
Well, so I want to put a period on this part of the conversation to say, Angelo, you remind me, as you said, that race has been the problem that MARTA has struggled with since its creation, which led me to suddenly wonder, where is the Thomas B. Murphy to take that out? Look, the late great speaker, rural speaker, guy who represented a rural constituency, and it was Thomas B. Murphy who actually had the vision to push MARTA through a legislature that had no interest public transportation.
Well, Speaker Murphy was an FDR Democrat. Truth be told, and he had seen what investment in infrastructure and what the New Deal had done for job creation and for rebuilding an economy.
Okay.
And I think that's exactly where he came from.
All right, I want to move on because we've only got a few minutes left, and I do want to take a minute to say a few words, especially with you, Rusty, about Nancy Reagan, who died on Sunday. So I know you've dealt with her. I want to say one quick story. She came to Atlanta in October of 1985 when Ronald Reagan was running for re-election, and she was promoting her Just Say No to Drugs policy back then. And the story that I love was watching her come out of a shop. I think she was at Cumberland Mall, actually, and she came out of a store, and there were several of us standing there to get sound with her. And one of us, I don't remember who, said, "Are you here for the campaign? Are you here, you know, for your husband's reelection campaign?" And she made that statement that for whatever reason got all this attention. This petite, well-dressed, well-put-together, refined lady said, "No, I'm not here for politics. I'm just here for the drugs." And that quote became a, for whatever reason, it got out there before the days of Facebook and Twitter. Her husband came to town a few months after the reelection, spoke at Northside High School, and reminded everybody of his wife's comment. Rusty, what's your quick story about her?
Well, Nancy Reagan, I was a very junior press aide in the 19 Reagan campaign and had several opportunities. I'll tell you this one story that I've told several. We were in Macon, and we were trying to get an Athletes for Reagan operation going. We asked Greg Brezina from the Falcons to head it up. And Greg was and is a very deeply religious guy. And he asked Governor Reagan about his personal experience with Christ. And Ms. Reagan was sitting to my left. I didn't see her, but I felt her tense up, because that was an area she had this very clear delineation between where politics started and ended and where the personal started and ended. And Greg had gone into her personal realm. Now, the governor then did a magnificent job of answering it, but she was as stiff as a board that whole time, because she felt that that particular personal political veil had been pierced, and she wasn't happy about it at all.
All right. Well, she was an amazing figure in politics. Did you ever get to deal with her, Kyle?
I did not.
Okay. No. All right. Well, she was really something to watch. All right. Look, we are out of time for this week's show. Next Tuesday, of course, we've got the Ohio primary, the Florida primary. We'll be back on this Friday at 3 o'clock with a much more in-depth preview with our panel of those important races. But in the meantime, I'm thrilled to have you, Angelo Fuster, Senator Nan Orrick, Mayor Rusty Paul, Kyle Wingfield of the AJC, here today to talk about politics with us. As we go out today, I just want to take a minute to remind people that we'd love to get you to join us on Twitter. At PoliticsGPB is our Twitter handle, and we really want to keep the conversation going. It's a brand new handle, and so we're hoping to encourage everybody to start following us and join us. Share this conversation with us here every time we're on the air, Wednesdays and Fridays. My thanks to our great team, Daryl Welch, our research and booking producer, Jenny Ament, our producer, and Clarissa Eisenvogel, whose name I always struggle with because it's Dutch and I can't quite get it, but she's our terrific intern. And hey, my daughter, Emma Pearl Nigut, sitting in the control room watching us home from spring break for the day. I'm Bill Nigut. That's all the time we have for this week's Political Rewind, but we will be back with you on Friday at 3 o'clock. Thanks for joining us today. Bye-bye.